On The Murder Squad, we discuss details of crimes that are often violent in nature. Listener discretion is advised.
I'm Billy Jensen.
I'm Paul Holes.
This is The Murder Squad.
From 2003 to 2004, residents in Boys Town, Chicago feared a serial killer might be on the loose. A theater director, a senior analyst, and a high school teacher had all gone out to nightclubs in the area before being stabbed in their own homes. Security alerts were sent out to the community after the second murder, with a description of the man and just a first name, Fernando.
But by 2016, all but one of the cases would be solved. The one searching for Fernando. The case reminded me of another one I had covered in another major city, New York. A man went out bar hopping on Christmas Eve, with plans the next day for a big family Christmas dinner. But his family found him murdered in his apartment Christmas evening. Both cases are still unsolved. Our job? To find the killers of Kevin Kluwer and Brian Booth.
This is the Murder Squad. So, Stephen, you're looking awfully clean-shaven right now, unlike Billy.
I am. I know. Billy and I are trading off. I shaved off the mustache for the first time in 8 years.
Wow. Yeah, you know, I was not allowed to grow facial hair for basically 24 years of my adult life with the sheriff's office. You know, I could do a...
Oh, yeah.
I could do a mustache and a mustache that could grow like a quarter inch past the corner of my mouth if I wanted that little handlebar, but couldn't do any beard. So when I got over to the DA's office, that's when I first grew out a goatee and found out that, oh, I'm all gray now in my beard.
is that a thing where in that situation it's like, oh, now that I have the freedom to grow anything I want, do you like grow your hair long? Like, do you see people all of a sudden get funky hairstyles and funky facial hair?
Absolutely. You take advantage of it. You're kind of curious, you know, what can happen? You know, let me grow my hair out, which, you know, as you know, for me, as I got older, I couldn't grow my hair out as much, but it's still, you know, it's from being more clean shaven and more of that, you know, high and tight type of hairstyle. Once I retired, I had a little bit more freedom.
Nice. Well, Billy, you'll appreciate this. When I worked at Disneyland, as you know, that was my first job when I was 17. I worked at Pizza Port. They had a very they had a very strict policy regarding hair and facial hair that I think they've relaxed now. But you couldn't have your hair below your if you were a guy, you couldn't have your hair below your ears. And if you had a mustache, it basically had to be 70s handlebar or nothing else. Very specific.
Yeah, well, you know what? I couldn't grow a beard until like 2 years ago, really. And I don't know why. I don't know what, you know, but, you know, the reason why we're bringing this up, obviously, is that Stephen broke the internet a few weeks ago, since we're recording this a little bit ahead of time, by shaving. And that was probably the most talked about story. Did it trend on Twitter?
I don't know. I mean, who knows? I mean, it's actually funnier that I did it right when, because today, as of today's recording, it's my 5-year anniversary working on MFM.
That's also right. Yes.
Kind of coincided at the same time. So I don't know if that had anything to do with it, but.
All right. Okay. So, you know, we usually try to update cases we've already brought to you in this section right before we get into the main story, but we wanted to highlight a recent unsolved case out of Dallas. The police are actively asking people for information, and we wanted to amplify that request. On April 24th, police found 38-year-old Tiffany Thomas shot at a car wash on American Way. Tiffany is a Black transgender woman. Her murder is the 19th death of a trans person due to violence this year. We reported cases similar to Tiffany's last year, but with this case being so recent, we couldn't pull together a full episode, but we really wanted to get that information out there. Important to ask for that information sort of on a national level, not just on a local level. So we just wanted to just give that an amplification, get it loud. So if you have information, you can contact Crime Stoppers at 214-373-TIPS, which is 214-373-8255. 8477. But for now, we're going to go to Chicago, Illinois. In the early 2000s, 31-year-old Kevin Kluwer moved to the Boys Town neighborhood in Chicago. Kevin's family supported him and became advocates in the LGBTQ plus community. According to his brother Ron, Kevin chose to move to Boys Town because he, quote, wanted to live somewhere he could be comfortable being himself. Choose Chicago refers to Boys Town as, quote, one of the country's most inclusive LGBTQ plus communities and the oldest officially recognized gay neighborhood in the United States. It's known for its welcoming vibe, nonstop nightlife, LGBTQ plus owned businesses, and excellent dining options, end quote. In 2004, the neighborhood was thought to be among the safest parts to live in the city. Kevin lived with a roommate on the 3400 block of North Elaine Place. He was also working as a senior cost analyst at Flextronics. Kevin made plans to go out on the night of March 23rd, 2004. His roommate couldn't go because he had to get up early for work the next morning. So he went bar hopping with his friend John Siracusa. The two went to Halsted Street, which is also known as the Strip, and that street is sort of filled with bars and restaurants. There's a lot to choose from.
John and Kevin were at Roscoe's when Kevin met a man named Fernando. The trio left Roscoe's and walked roughly two blocks to Little Jim's around 3:15 a.m. After spending some time at Little Jim's, Kevin and Fernando went back to his place. The next day, March 24th, Kevin didn't make it to work. His boss at Flextronics called his emergency contact, his mom Pam. Pam then called Kevin's brother Ron and his dad Jim to see if they had seen Kevin. They hadn't. Jim drove over to Kevin's apartment to check on him. When he arrived, Kevin's car was still at the apartment. Jim went up to the third floor where his son's apartment was. Around 6 p.m., he discovered his son's body in his bedroom and called the authorities. Kevin had been stabbed 42 times in the back.
So, 42 stab wounds in the back. What is that, Paul? What's going on here?
You know, of course, as I've said before, I always want to see what the distribution of the stab wounds are. You know, are these stab wounds tightly grouped, indicating that the victim has been, you know, restrained? Or are they spread around as if the victim is moving around, trying to fight with the offender at the time of the stabbing? However, if all the stab wounds are in the back, this almost sounds like almost a blitz attack when Kevin's back was turned to the offender, as if the offender just waited for an opportunity, which lessened the threat to him. If Kevin is not aware of what's about to happen, now the offender can basically pounce and start stabbing and possibly immobilize Kevin and reduce the risk of harm to himself.
Yeah. So, and obviously you'd like to think that the investigators, you know, they're going to speak to the roommate. They're going to speak to the friend that he was out with. Hopefully they're going to check all of the surveillance video. Yeah. You hope.
Yeah.
So they did speak to Kevin's roommate. He told them he heard multiple voices in the middle of the night. He didn't look to see what time it was, and he wasn't sure how many people were in the apartment. He did remember that right around 4 a.m., he heard the door close. He wasn't sure if it was people coming or going from the apartment, though. The roommate left for work at 6:30 a.m., and at the time, he didn't notice or hear anything strange. Kevin's bedroom door was shut, and the dining room window was open. Police then spoke with his friends, and at least two of his friends, John and another person, told them about Fernando. There wasn't much to go on beyond the first name and the description. According to some reports, Fernando was a sex worker in the area. And another report, quoting an investigator, said he was a busboy at a restaurant off of I-55 and 83. The description of Fernando was that he was a white Hispanic man around 25 years old. He was 5'7" with a slim athletic build. He spoke with a Hispanic or European Spanish accent. And they compiled a sketch of this Fernando. Anything coming out in you with this sketch? He definitely has sort of like a mop of hair on his head. I can tell that.
You know, when I look at this sketch, yeah, he's definitely, you know, got that mop of hair, but he has a very distinctive, almost elongated face. You know, and assuming the sketch is accurate, and of course, we've seen composites be pretty spot on, but we've also seen composites be way off. It's a complex transfer of information to describe what you can remember, you know, to somebody who's trying to draw what you are seeing in your mind's eye. But there is enough characteristics in this sketch that I would think that, you know, there'd be aspects about this composite that would stand out to somebody if they took the time to actually pay attention. If there's somebody that is visiting these nightclubs, they might recognize who this person is based off this composite.
So while police were trying to track down Fernando, they sent an alert to the community. Kevin wasn't the first gay man murdered in the area recently. The police wanted those living in this area to be vigilant. They urged residents not to allow strangers in their home. Both Kevin and the other victim were thought to have brought new acquaintances home the night that they were killed.
The other murder occurred in August of 2003. 38-year-old Brad Winters had gone out on the night of August 17th. To Halsted Street, just like Kevin. He and his friend Diane Collins went bar hopping. The two ended up at Little Jim's. According to the Chicago Reader, around 11 p.m., Brad put Diane in a cab and promised to talk the next day. Brad then went back to Little Jim's. According to the Little Jim's manager, Brad left around midnight, alone. At around 3 or 4 a.m., two of Brad's neighbors recall hearing somebody say, "Help!" and "Somebody!" And they thought it might have been college students. But then Brad failed to show up for work 2 days later. A coworker went to his apartment in Lincoln Park to check on him. Inside was Brad's body. He was naked, strangled, and stabbed. The back door was open and his wallet and cell phone were missing. Chicago police took blood samples from the living room and bathtub. They also scraped under Brad's fingernails. We weren't able to view the autopsy report, but according to the funeral director, Brad had 24 stab wounds and blows to the head.
So, Paul, both of these look awfully similar. Multiple stab wounds, and they very well could have met this person on Halsted Street, which is that strip in Boys Town.
Yeah, you know, and that would be one of my primary concerns after the second case is that possibly both him and Kevin ran into the same offender. And, you know, they end up going back to a residence where now the offender seizes upon an opportunity in order to be able to do the killing.
The community was frustrated with law enforcement. According to CBS Chicago, the police waited weeks before issuing the safety alert about the possible threat. The police said in the alert they didn't believe the cases were related, but they wanted the community to be safe. And the concern grew even more on Halloween 2004. High school special education teacher Charles Gibson was discovered murdered in his condo in Edgewater. He was naked and had been stabbed multiple times. Some reports said he had gone to some of the same bars as Kevin and Brad. But early on, investigators told the area the cases were not connected. But a six-person investigative team was set up to investigate all three cases. So, Paul, when you set up a six-person investigation team, is that it's not necessarily a task force, because task force is usually between different agencies. But, you know, you say you're setting up this six-person team, but you're also very quickly dismissing that they're not connected. Why would you do that?
You know, that's so hard to tell in terms of not knowing exactly the details of the information they were dealing with. I think based on the circumstances, you have to consider the possibility up front that there's a relation. You have three male victims all visiting the same general area, being killed in similar manners. You have to consider the possibility that you have the same offender working. However, there could be significant differences within the details of the case that the investigators are taking a look at, and we may not know those details right now.
Right.
Unlike with Kevin and Brad's murder, investigators had answers in Charles' case within the month. On
November 24th, the Area 3 headquarters for Chicago Police held a press conference. Charles had met a man named Ollie Rockman on October 22nd at the gay country and western bar Charlie's. That night, the two spent time alone and left on good terms. Then on October 30th, the two men went out. That night, they fought in Charles' condo. During the fight, Rockman had injured himself and left his blood behind. But even with Charles' murder being quickly solved, the police had no new leads on Kevin and Brad's cases. Police News Affair Director David Bayless told the Windy City Times, "It's important that people not let their guard down. This incident occurred because the victim brought someone in that he didn't know very well. Ultimately, whether there's one offender or three, it doesn't change how people should act about bringing strangers into their homes."
Okay, so we know that the police aren't always incredibly tactful, but saying this incident occurred because the victim brought someone in that he didn't know very well. No, the incident occurred because this guy was an asshole murderer. And, you know, you should preface that before that. But it's just, you know, when people talk like this, you're not going to. And there's a ripple effect here, because if the police are saying this and which they might think it's not victim blamey, but the ripple effect then is that you have a community then that is going to say the police don't get it, they don't care, and they're going to be less liable to talk, cooperate with the police and everything.
Yeah. Right. You know, and most certainly you want to put the responsibility on the offender. You know, often law enforcement is trying to tell people how to prevent themselves from becoming victims. And in using language such as this, it is putting the blame on the people and how they're living is what's causing these people to be hurt or to be killed. And the reality is, it's you notify the community, say there is somebody out there that is possibly seeking to do you harm. You know, be careful. How you don't want to restrict people from their freedoms, you know, and that's probably where now they're overstepping in terms of saying, stop doing this if you don't want to become a victim.
So both Brad and Kevin's cases remain cold. Kevin's family continued to try and find justice. The year after his death, they regularly went down to Boys Town and passed out flyers hoping to get more information. Almost exactly a year after Kevin's murder, both of his parents passed away. And his older brother, Ron, continues to look for answers. In March of 2013, they began working with the Morton College Institute for Cold Case Solution in Cicero. While working on the case, former Chicago police officer George Sable discovered that Chicago police had interviewed and held a Fernando for several days in 2005. The man was questioned, he was given a polygraph, and after he passed the polygraph, investigators believed this particular Fernando to be a material witness, not the suspect. And the detective claimed it was clear from the case file that Chicago PD didn't really try very hard. He posited that the investigation should focus on someone other than Fernando. And he believed the person was spoken to by police and was present the night of Kevin's murder.
You know, this last bit of information about Siebel believing that the person was spoken to by police and was present the night of Kevin's murder, I'm not sure what he is basing that theory on. If he's not believing that it was a Fernando and police spoke with many Fernandos, what else is he looking at to say, oh, they actually talked to who Siebel thinks is the offender? I need to know more in order to be able to form an opinion as to whether or not police actually did. And this could be very misleading to the public in terms of, oh, police already know and have spoken to the guy. I'm not confident that police have identified the offender in Kevin's case.
So then 3 years later, hope was renewed. A man in Texas was convicted on drug charges. The man's DNA was put into the system, and it matched the evidence from Brad Winter's crime scene. The man's name was Ramon Smith. Smith had a lengthy criminal history ranging from aggravated robbery, prostitution, which is the police designation, assault and theft. Ramon pleaded guilty and gave no motive, gave no details on what happened. He was sentenced to 24 years in prison, and no link was made to Kevin's case.
So then in 2019, a new detective was placed on Kevin's case. Detective John Campbell was reviewing all the evidence and looking for new avenues. He had plenty to say about Fernando to Fox 32 Chicago. The biggest thing he wanted to correct was from the rumors in 2013. He clarified that they had not spoken to the correct Fernando yet. He did confirm they had talked to many Fernandos, but not the one that was with Kevin that night. Campbell also discussed the fingerprints that were found at the crime scene. He had requested the FBI to register them in Europe. The feeling being, if Fernando was from a European country, perhaps Spain or Portugal, it would be helpful to have them in their system.
So, you know, we get this question a lot. I think it's super important. What happens when you have a suspect that you think might be from another country? We talk so much about the DNA database. We've told people, put your, and most of our listeners are from America, but hello out there to our listeners in Australia and Canada and England and New Zealand and everywhere else. But I will not mention Australia and not mention New Zealand. But the, you know, GEDmatch is only one thing. GEDmatch is something that can be international, but when we're looking at CODIS, CODIS is really just America.
Yeah.
Do you know how these other countries are doing in terms of their DNA databases, and how easy is it for a detective from over here to use that database and say, you know what? I've got a sample over here. There's a possibility this guy might be from Spain or Portugal or the Netherlands. Can we use your database and see?
Oh, it's not easy at all. So I've actually had to do this, and different countries are at different states within their DNA technology. In fact, some countries are using different DNA markers than what the United States are using in their for databasing. And in part, the FBI within the last few years expanded the STR markers, the type of DNA that is used by law enforcement, up to 21 STRs in part in order to have markers that are inclusive of markers that are being used by significant countries overseas, such as the UK, in order to be able to search those databases. The world is not standardized, not on the DNA technology side, nor on DNA laws. So we have certain restrictions on who and what and when we can search DNA. Well, other countries have different laws. And so even though we may be investigating a horrible homicide here in the United States, the situation may not fall under the proper laws that another country may have. So it is very hit or miss as to whether or not you can search another country's DNA database, whether it be because of limitations in technology or the laws. The way that I've done it and the way that it is typically done is going through Interpol. And a DNA profile is put out there saying, hey, we've got this case with this set of circumstances with this DNA profile. And you ask other countries via Interpol, will you search your database? And it is completely voluntary, of course, for the other countries to choose whether or not they will search it. So it's a very frustrating thing, especially if you think you are pursuing an offender that came from outside the United States.
And how often does that, do they take the, you know, when you did go through Interpol, did they tell you how many countries said, yeah, we'll do it, and then how it checked? Or did you just
you do get through the FBI's CODIS administrator, you'll get information as to which countries actually responded, but there's also countries that never even acknowledge that they haven't even entertained that request. So, you know, like for me, I had one suspect actually in GSK that was over in Germany, and I knew he was in the Germany database. And so I was able to eliminate him because Germany searched and gave the FBI information back that he did not match the GSK profile. But if he had been in another country that chose, no, not going to bother with this,
I would have no idea if he was maybe incarcerated or his DNA sample was in a different country's DNA database. It's that's just sort of the rolling of the dice. You have to use it. You have to go after it. But you can never be confident that you've completely searched, comprehensively searched all international databases that are available to you.
Yeah. Yeah. So in April 2021, Kevin's brother Ron held a press conference along with Crime Stoppers. Ron said the police have made strides since Detective Campbell took over, but they still are looking for that one piece of information, which is where the murder squad comes in. You know, this is a case that, you know, very much reminds me of a case that I covered back in 2003 in New York, which I'm going to get to in a second. But with that case and this case, you look at them and people would always ask me, which cases bother you the most? And it was this one, the one from New York, because just like with this one, you know, this guy's going to kill again. You know, it's there's a MO here that this guy is picking people up at bars. They're going back to hit the victim's place and then killing them.
It absolutely sounds predatory to me. Kevin's case does, for sure.
So the case I worked on in 2003 in New York is a 35-year-old named Brian Booth. And he had plans to spend Christmas with his family. And this was in Christmas of 2002. On Christmas Eve, he went to work before finishing up some Christmas shopping at the Gap. And he bought his nieces some presents. Then he stopped at Rite Aid and the dollar store. He went back to his apartment. He wrapped the presents. He checked in with his mom again to confirm about Christmas dinner. He would be home out on Long Island the next day at 2 p.m. Then he went out for a drink. So he started the evening around 6:15 p.m. at a bar called The Phoenix in the East Village. Then he was spotted at the Wonder Bar. And finally, he ended up at his last stop, which is a place called The Cock. According to Brian's best friend, it was, quote, a place you would go at the end of the night if you wanted to pick up a date. So he was pretty certain that Brian would have met someone at that bar. Witnesses said he left the bar around 1 a.m., but no one saw Brian arrive home, and no one could really recall seeing if he left the Cock alone.
2 p.m. Christmas Day arrived. Brian had not shown up for the family dinner. His family was immediately alarmed. He was usually early. They tried to call him, but he didn't answer. Around 6 p.m., Brian's brother Jimmy and his brother-in-law arrived at his Stuyvesant Town apartment in Manhattan. Jimmy had a key and let the two men inside the 8th-floor apartment. In Brian's bedroom doorway, they found Brian's body on his side in a pool of blood. According to reports, he was nude, wrapped in a blanket, and his head was facing the door. There were no signs of a struggle or forced entry. The door was locked. On the kitchen counter were 3 beer bottles, and Brian still had drink tokens in his pocket. His laptop and cell phone were missing, but his wallet was in his dresser and contained $160. The Christmas presents he wrapped before going out were still in the house, and they were wrapped. Brian had been stabbed. The murder weapon, a kitchen knife, was found at the scene. In the bag with the Christmas presents, the medical examiner said the knife had entered the left side of Brian's neck and penetrated his trachea, esophagus, and right lung. His tox screen showed no signs of drugs, and his BAC was around 0.05.
So we're going to get this in a second. The family had reached out to me, or I reached out to the family. This is one of my very, very first cases. But the news originally called this a suicide. That was what the headline was, that this was a, you know, man in a Stuyvesant apartment, suicide. I know we don't have the police report, but suicide, you know, stabbing yourself in the neck is something that is just, you can't think of it. And this is, you know, thinking about going through the trachea and the esophagus and all of that. It was obvious that this wasn't a suicide, as we'll talk about in a little bit. But this manner of death, what do you see here?
Well, you know, when it comes to suicide, it is what people do to themselves can be very bizarre and on the extreme. I actually have a case in which a man cut his own throat. So it is a possibility, but it's what the medical examiner is saying here is sort of taken out of context. Without the crime scene reports, without the autopsy, full autopsy information, it's tough to say. However, because this is such an unusual
cause of death, that most certainly homicide needs to be involved from the very beginning. And hopefully that is what happened. As you get CSIs out, you get homicide investigators out, they treat it like a homicide until proven otherwise.
Yeah, so there was nothing really at the scene that spoke to this being a suicide. But one of the reasons why they jumped to that conclusion is that Brian's brother Tommy died by suicide 3 months earlier. And an unnamed police source told the media that this is why Brian killed himself. Completely ridiculous. You know, his family repeatedly said this is not the case. Brian's life was actually going well. He had a good job. He had great friends. He had just planned a $4,000 ski trip with friends to Aspen. He was, you know, going home for Christmas. And yes, you know, if somebody is potentially going to take their own life, they... you know, they could be doing any everything could look great and they could do this, but it just wasn't looking like that. And bottom line is the crime scene didn't show that.
Yeah.
According to Brian's sister, Donna, the detectives looking at her brother's case were indifferent and homophobic. There was a detective, Danaher, and I remember dealing with this guy, who told her, "We don't know what happened in this homosexual crime." This is a quote. "Sometimes it's people they know. There is a different culture in these clubs, people picking people up. You don't know what goes on in these clubs." So Donna and the rest of the family continued to try and find leads. The family wanted to hang up posters to ask for tips. Now, here's the thing. They wanted to hang up posters and ask for tips around that community. And that community would be able, you know, did you see something, whatever. But they weren't able to do it because there wasn't a cause of death. There was not a homicide investigation. They were calling this a suicide. So they called the medical examiner's office and they said, "Can we please have this be determined a homicide?" The medical examiner's office told them, "Talk to the police." On January 20th, 2003, something happened that made Donna push this issue even further. Someone called her from Brian's phone. She answered, but no one replied. Then 4.5 hours later, another call came in. And this time she could hear what she described as two Hispanic men. And they were saying, "Where's Brian?" And Donna said they sounded like they were drunk at a bar. Donna called the police. At first, they tried to tell her there had been absolutely no activity on Brian's phone since December 26. But then Brian's family got his phone records. And someone had actually tried to retrieve his voicemails on his phone. And someone had called his mom's house.
So Brian's sister also uncovered other information she shared with the police. In the weeks before his death, Brian had spoken to two unknown men multiple times. Both of these men, Brian called after 3 a.m. She insisted they look into who they were. The police told her they found them and spoke with them. The men were not suspects. Gay City News also reached out to the two men. They spoke to one who said he met Brian in a bar and they traded emails and phone calls. The two didn't see each other again. The other man never responded. After months of the case being misrepresented as a suicide, the NYPD finally ruled Brian's death a homicide on March of 2003. The family could finally hang posters. They could finally speak to the media and say Brian was murdered.
Now, again, you know, 3 months passing, not to mention the fact that this was over the holidays, too.
Sure.
And it's another thing that bothered me about this case that we brought up, actually, with the case in Chicago. And this could have very well been somebody that was from overseas, not from New York. So being able to get the posters up would have been so key. Being able to canvass the area and talk to people with the police, they should have done that. Instead, they said it was a suicide. They went straight to suicide. None of that was done. Tape was not pulled, all of that. So frustrating.
Well, and I think, you know, with a suicide, the likelihood that they are receiving updates as to phone activity from Brian's phone is almost zero. There's no reason to in a suicide case versus if this was worked as a homicide from the very beginning, they are now knowing that the phone is missing, the family saying, "I'm receiving phone calls from Brian's phone." They are now going to be
actively pursuing getting all the information and location information as to where those calls came from and tracking down who has Brian's phone. It may not be an offender. It may be a random that found the phone, discarded, but it's still important to know where that phone was, how it was discovered, how it's being used.
So the family tried to get more answers about the crime scene and who would have killed Brian. They were told they couldn't look at the crime scene information because they were family. Investigators told them they believed Brian was killed by someone he knew and trusted. When the family was finally able to get back into Brian's apartment in April of 2003, they found a bloody laundry bag and a business card near the knives in the kitchen. No one knew the person named on the business card, and they were troubled by the amount of blood evidence left behind. They asked the police, and the investigators said they had more than enough blood at the scene, and that the blood on the bag was most likely Brian's. So this family was so frustrated, they turned to a group called Parents of Murdered Children, and which is how I got involved with Parents of Murdered Children and becoming one of their media advisors. They just didn't know where to turn because they just had to keep pushing and pushing. And Brian was lucky enough to have family that was able to do this. Just imagine the cases that happen that don't have family. You know, it's just filed away as okay, suicide, and then that's it. So, you know, with the obviously that blood evidence isn't there again. I remember that they finally gave them the bag that had the Christmas presents in it, and they gave it back to the family, to the Booth family. But, you know, it's one of those cases where every time I think about it, especially around the holidays, I just think that guy definitely went out and killed again.
Yeah, very possible. And quite frankly, I would not have given the family back that bag with the Christmas presents. Because that's where the weapon was found, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yep.
We don't, that's you know, maybe the weapon was merely dropped in there, or maybe the offender interacted significantly with that bag and you could potentially have evidence on it. I don't know. You obviously were in the dark in terms of specifics. I've run into the situation where family is frustrated because they see things. They see blood still remaining at a crime scene after it's been processed. Well, typically CSIs sample the blood. They don't collect all the blood. And to an inexpert eye, you may not necessarily recognize how that blood evidence has been sampled. But if this case was deemed a suicide as early as it was, it is possible that the crime scene had limited processing. And that would be my concern, is that they did not treat this as a homicide at the very beginning. And so it was very almost superficial, more of a death investigation type of scene processing than a full blown homicide investigation, crime scene processing, two totally different levels of processing. And was there evidence left behind that could potentially solve the case? That would be my concern.
Yeah. Okay. So that leads us to our weekly assignment. Since Kevin Kluwer's death on March 24, 2004, Kevin's brother Ron runs a website called forchicagokev.com. The website has a photo gallery, links, thoughts from the family, news articles, and a page about this Fernando. Again, Kevin was murdered in his Lakeview apartment in the Boys Town area of Chicago. He was stabbed and authorities are still looking to talk to a man who went by that name, Fernando. He was described as a white Hispanic man around 25 years old, 5'7", with a slim athletic build. Spoke with a Hispanic or European Spanish accent. So if you have any information at all, you can send it to us, or you can call Crime Stoppers at 800-535-STOP, or you can call the Chicago Police Area 3 Homicide at 312-744-8261. And there's a $1,000 reward leading to the arrest. Now for Brian Booth. Brian Booth was murdered on Christmas Eve 2002 in his Manhattan apartment. And like we said, the case was mishandled by the police and was mishandled by the media at the time. His family was adamant in their search to find his killer. But his parents and sister Donna have now passed away. We want to continue the search to find his killer. If you have any information, please contact us.
Yeah. You know, and on Kevin's case, I want to emphasize one thing. You know, we have this name Fernando, but you think about this offender in his mindset. He's going into a nightclub scene. And even if he's just looking for a hookup, and whether or not he is wanting to commit violence, it is very possible he's using a pseudonym. So the name Fernando may be a made-up name, and it's something we have to look for Fernandos, but we don't want the murder squad to just eliminate the possibility that he has a different name. You know, that composite is from witnesses that saw this man with Kevin. And so if you know somebody that looks like that composite that is frequenting those nightclubs, and you know that person's name, feed it to law enforcement or give it to us.
Definitely. So that brings us to the rules. Don't name names in public, no side-by-sides, no doxing. And that takes us to the weekly distraction. Paul, I'm going to go first. There's a Instagram account that you could tell that I get all my my entertainment now on Instagram. But there's an Instagram account called Route 9 Signs. And this is a guy that does these small scale signs, like of old school, let's say the Dunes Hotel or the Stardust Hotel in Vegas, or he's done the Safari Inn, and he'll take the sign and he'll make it really, really small. And it's so freaking detailed. And then he'll take the sign and then bring it to where the sign was, you know, where the sign is, and then hold them up side by side. And it's amazing. And he's just so intricate in it. Just check it out. Route 9 Signs. The guy's name is Chris. And I'm just like, yeah, this is one of them right here. Can you see that one? See that?
Oh, wow. Okay.
Sands. Yeah.
I was going to ask, how small is he making these signs? Well, that's, you know, considering that's a large sign, he's made it pretty small.
No, exactly. No, it's not that big. It's maybe the you know, a foot tall, if that. And I was talking to him. If I was like, if I ever got one done, there was a Mr. Donut in East Meadow, New York. And I remember my dad taking me there, and they would, you know, he would tell me stories because it was right near where he grew up. He would tell me stories about him getting into fights and all that stuff like that. So I love that Mr. Donut sign. Unfortunately, that Mr. Donut sign then got the Mr. Donut went out of business and got taken over by Dunkin' Donuts. Dunkin' Donuts gets rid of the sign, of course.
Yeah.
And now the building's completely gone.
Well, but so are there historic photos of that Mr. Donut sign?
There are. Yeah. So So check him out, Route 9 Signs, everybody. He just has some, you know, just some really, really cool stuff. And people get them for like, you know, for their, you know, probably like a good Father's Day gift, to be honest with you, you know, but it's one guy like working out of like, you know, but it's pretty intense. It's cool.
Yeah.
Paul, if you were to have a sign recreated for you in miniature form from your youth, what would it be?
Oh, geez. Actually, you know, my dad was military, and so we bounced around the United States growing up, and I spent, I think it was 5th through the 7th grade in San Antonio, Texas. And one of our special nights out was a restaurant, and I believe it was called the Magic Time Machine. And it was the coolest restaurant. You know, at every single booth and table inside this restaurant had a theme to it. And then all the waiters would dress up. And I remember like one waiter dressed up as, is it Pan, the one that plays the flute, you know, with the goat legs? Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it was such a, for a kid, it was such a unique environment. And it had this kind of goofy sign out front. And the restaurant itself was somewhat an unusual shape. And I'd love to see that replicated. I think that would be really cool.
All right. I just Googled it right now. It still looks like it's still open.
Is it really? I would have assumed it was long gone.
Oh, no, wow. It's still open. That's amazing.
Oh, that's cool. I'll have to go there
someday. Magic Time Machine. Yeah. Oh, it looks so cool inside. Oh, we got to go. All right. Well, if we ever do a tour,
There you go. In San Antonio, Texas.
Hit up San Antonio.
Yeah, Billy and I will be at the Magic Time Machine.
We will be there. What about you, Polly?
Well, I know my sign is still there, but I've probably the gigantic ice cream cone on top of Zesto's would be like, if I was going to replicate something to put in my apartment or my home out here, it would be, that's where we went after baseball games and football games and theater performances. And so that would probably, it's like a giant soft serve dipped in chocolate. And then at Christmas time, they put lights around the top of it.
Hmm. Oh, cool. Okay.
Yeah.
How about you, Steven?
It's got to be the Jurassic Park sign.
Of course. You're predictable.
I know. I know. I'm sorry. It's just such a great, and it's actually funny when they redid the ride at Universal a couple years ago, I actually saw them throwing away the original, or at least like dumping it somewhere to change up the sign to Jurassic World. And I was like, but if you're just going to throw it away,
walk away with it.
I know I was on the tour, so I couldn't, but I was just like, I just reached out. I was like, just like, it's just going to sit in a warehouse. Just give it to me.
You're right. It probably would just sit in a warehouse. I've actually seen, actually, you know what? I'm not even going to mention it because I might actually buy it for you. but yes. So anyway.
Well, you know, my distraction, I've got multiple distractions, and you know, just briefly, I don't talk about family much, but I did have my daughter and granddaughter over for, you know, a week, came out from California, was out here for a week. First time I've really been able to see my granddaughter, who's now 11 months old. So that was a great time. And you know, I became quite attached to that little bugger. You know, it was hard to see them leave. But I think, you know, right now here in Colorado, we are starting to see where we've got some relaxation for those that are fully vaccinated of having to wear face masks. And most notably, you know, I go to this gym to work out, and it is so weird, and it's sad to say, it's so weird to actually see other people's faces that you've been working out with for the last year and a half, and not knowing what they look like. And then now everybody's got their face masks off, and it's like, oh, this is odd. You know, now it's like, it seems unfamiliar to see other people's faces. And that's what this pandemic has done. It's just, it's such a surreal state we are in.
Yes. And I will say this, Paul.
Oh,
you were actually, someone did actually spot your face there, I noticed on social media.
What?
Yes.
I don't know
people
anything about
in the Murderino group. Is that that's your zip code, right? Or your area code? Excuse me.
Oh yeah, it is. I'm a little scared. I'm a bit
someone
scared
said,
now.
Yep. Someone spotted you there, dude.
At the gym.
Yes. Yeah. Someone spotted
really?
You at the gym. Yeah. Yep.
Oh Jesus. I. It's because I like my anonymity, and that's one thing the face masks kind of afforded.
Yes.
Oh, geez. You'll have to forward me that information, and I'll have to keep my eye out.
I will
as to
forward
who's...
you that information.
Okay. Oh, my. Okay. I'm a little... No, that,
all right,
that is a shocker. I did not know that.
Yes. Boom. All right. So everyone, and I think somebody was saying too, I read some of the comments on it, and one person is like, they were hoping to get to have to deliver Postmates to you because they were at Postmates deliver or something like that. So
okay.
I thought that was interesting. Of course, we don't do Postmates. We do Grubhub, which was I don't think they're an advertiser anymore, but you know what? Grubhub, you can come back. It's okay. All right. Yeah. So if you know what, Paul, because it was all you, with being spotted, I'm going to let you pick the password today.
All right. Well, you know, I have to go with a squirrel themed password, and I think the password, in fact, the password's going to be acorn. How's that?
All right. There you go, everyone. So thank you so much, everyone. Please rate, review, and subscribe. You know what? Those are the biggest things. Tell your friends. We'd love to see this podcast get out to as many people as possible so we can solve some of these crimes. And you know what? Until then, you've got some work to do. You've got some assignments. If you're new to the podcast, go check out all the other episodes and keep digging.
Keep digging. Jensen and Holes, The Murder Squad, is produced by Exactly Right Media and Bench Clearing Productions. Senior producer, Paulie Katowski. Associate producer, Haley Gray. Engineer, Stephen Ray Morris. Music, Tom Breifogel. Executive producers, Karen Kilgara, Georgia Hardstark, Danielle Kramer.